about it, but it never leaked into the everyday stuff. Joe has a great ability, and he had a great ability in New York. He has a great ability to diffuse things so they don't leak into his clubhouse, so they don't get to the players, so they don't become distractions. That's one of his best qualities. Maybe as the Yankees began to win over the summer, the victories bought Torrey a little more time, but it didn't change the reality that he was living in the crosshairs of people who wanted him gone. And probably anything short of a World Series championship would not have been enough. What was debilitating for him was knowing they no longer trusted him. And yet he was the same man who had helped bring home those 6 pennants and 4 world championships. Cashman has a problem telling people things, said Borzello, the bullpen catcher. He would say comments about Joe, like he did this or he did that in a game, and he'd be telling people who he must have known no one liked Joe. What, he didn't think Joe would hear it from them? But Cash operated that way all the time. It was a big problem. And then we would all talk about it and say, doesn't he realize we're all a family down here? The team pretty much knew if we didn't get to the World Series, he wasn't coming back, and there was no denying it. It wasn't so much that's what we were told. The silence said enough. There would be rumors out there or stuff in the papers about Joe's job being on the line, and nobody in the front office would deny it or say anything about it. The silence said it all. Joe never brought it up in the clubhouse, but we started to believe that Joe was gone. Said Torrey, I asked Donnie Mattingly about it, about not enjoying it. And he said the same thing. He didn't enjoy it. Even after winning games, we wouldn't enjoy it. I was drained. The questions came hot and heavy. A lot of it was because we started so badly. I find that when people talk about what they want to talk about, and it was about me getting fired, they don't want to consider the reasons why we may have started so badly. It's all about the bottom line, and it's all about what's going to be the fallout from it. Not about how many guys we had hurt. We had Abreu on the disabled list most of the spring. We had Johnny Damon, who stumbled out of the gate. You had pitchers on the DL. But that wasn't the back page. People wanted to get the meat and potatoes. I'm on the last year of a contract. And the media knew whoever was leaking the information. I just felt like it was coming at me from a lot of different directions, and I was uncomfortable with it. You'd like to think, if you work for somebody for a certain period of time, that there'd be a time where they'd trust you somewhat. And I never got that. Even when we were winning, I never got that. That bothered me. The Yankees won like nobody else after that kick-ass meeting in Toronto and that 21-29 start. They played 6.52 baseball over the final 4 months, the best record in baseball. It took much more than the usual little poke or nudge he would give his championship teams, but Torrey had found a way to get this team to respond, even after the 5th worst start to a season in franchise history. As the Yankees clobbered opponents and passed one team after another in the wild card race, Yankee Stadium buzzed that summer with the familiar electricity about the possibilities of another October. Life was good again in the Bronx. Except in the manager's office at Yankee Stadium. One day during the summer, even while the Yankees were winning with uncanny regularity, the only kind of regularity that could overcome a 21-29 beginning, Torrey looked around his office and saw the accumulations of a successful 12-year run. The trophies, the pictures, the baseballs, the small remnants of achievement, the little reminders of the awesome power of trust. Even with the wins coming apace, Torrey knew what was coming for him. He turned to his personal assistant, Chris Romanello. Chris, Torrey said, why don't you start packing some things up? The game on Friday night, July 20th, 2007, was a particularly ugly one for the Yankees, providing a harsh reminder that as far back as they had come from that 21-29 start, they still had a long, rough road to October. By the 5th inning, in front of 53,953 peeved fans at Yankee Stadium, the Yankees trailed the Tampa Bay Devil Rays 9-0, thanks to abysmal pitching from Mike Messina, who looked more and more as if his career was headed to its finish, and Edouard Ramirez, an independent league find by the Yankees whose career looked as if it might never get started. Messina allowed 6 earned runs in 4 2/3 innings, falling to 4-7 on the season. Torrey brought in Ramirez to stem the damage, but the carnage grew so bad as to be almost painful to watch. Ramirez threw 19 pitches. 17 of them were balls. One of the 2 pitches that wasn't a ball was hit for a grand slam. This was what the first 5 batters did against Ramirez. Walk, walk, grand slam, walk, walk. Yankees pitchers walked 10 batters in a game for the first time in 6 years. Edwin Jackson, a right-handed pitcher for Tampa Bay, who entered the game with a 1-9 record, befuddled the Yankees hitters, allowing no runs over 6 innings. The left-handed trio of Damon, Abreu, and Matsui went 1-14. Another lefty, Giambi, wasn't even in the lineup. The defeat dropped the Yankees to 49-46, their worst record after 95 games in 16 years. 26 other Yankee teams were 49-46 or worse after 95 games. None of them made the playoffs. All things considered, it was a good night to be in New Britain, Connecticut, instead of the Bronx. That is exactly where you could find all of the most important decision-makers in the Yankees' baseball operations department. Indeed, it was a beautiful evening at New Britain Stadium, home of the Rock Cats, the Minnesota Twins' AA affiliate. Temperature in the low 70s, low humidity, a nice breeze. It was a good night to dream. Into the 6,000-seat ballpark walked the who's who of Yankees brass. General manager Brian Cashman, stats guru and assistant general manager Billy Epler, head of player development Mark Newman, pitching guru Nardi Contreras. The Yankees naturally did not hire mere experts. They unearthed the gurus of their profession. And special advisor Reggie Jackson. They did not come for the comfort of the evening, nor for the $6.50 burritos, or the $5.50 Sam Adams cherry wheat drafts. They came to see the future. The Rock Cats were playing the Trenton Thunder, the Yankees' AA affiliate, who were starting a beefy 21-year-old right-handed pitcher named Jabba Chamberlain. Cashman, Epler, Newman, Contreras, and Jackson wanted to see if Chamberlain was ready to help the Yankees in their uphill climb. The single biggest reason that the Yankees dynasty had devolved into just another franchise, scrambling to even get into the playoffs as a wild card, was because Cashman and his gurus had made mistake after mistake after mistake when it came to evaluating pitchers, both on the major league and amateur sides. Kevin Brown, Randy Johnson, Jarrett Wright, Jeff Weaver, Steve Carsey, Esteban Loaiza, Kyle Farnsworth, Jose Contreras, Javier Vasquez, Kei Egawa, Carl Pavano, Roger Clemens, the 44-year-old version. None of those 12 pitchers, all brought in from outside the organization, pitched 3 consecutive seasons with the Yankees. None. It was a losing pattern that defied enormous odds. The Yankees would typically overvalue a pitcher, bringing him in when he was either at the end of his career or not a fit for New York, then dump the pitcher to move on to the next mistake. The balance sheet on those 12 investments was ugly. Record, 125-105, including 3-7 in the postseason. Cost, $255 million. Does not include prospects surrendered in trades. Cost per win, $2.04 million. Cashman was in New Britain because he had a pretty good inkling that flushing $255 million on pitching mistakes did not exactly make for good business practice. The Yankees put themselves in the position of dumping all that money on the wrong pitchers because they couldn't develop any decent pitchers of their own. They had to scramble to find available veteran pitchers because their system was producing nothing. And because the revenue-sharing system and new revenue streams put more money in the pockets of smaller revenue teams, the pool of available veteran pitchers for the Yankees to wave their money at was drying up. In another era, the Yankees might have cherry-picked elite pitchers in their prime from organizations that could no longer afford them, in the same way they had plucked David Cone from the Blue Jays in 1995 and Messina from the Orioles after playing out his contract in 2000. Instead, the Blue Jays locked up Roy Halladay, the Indians locked up C.C. Sabathia, the Brewers locked up Ben Sheets, the Astros locked up Roy Oswalt, and the Twins locked up Johan Santana. All small revenue teams who suddenly had the cash to keep their ace pitchers off the trade and free agent markets. The kicker for the Yankees was that under the revenue-sharing system, they were financing some of the newfound solvency of those teams. For the next decade after bringing Andy Pettitte to the big leagues in 1995, the Yankees did not use even one homegrown pitcher of any consequence with the exception of Ramiro Mendoza. And though he had value as a middle reliever, Mendoza was neither a starter nor a closer, the premium slots for a pitcher. So each year the Yankees had to fill spots in their staff by trading for or buying somebody else's problems. Cashman recognized the downward spiral such desperation created, so in 2006 he began to prioritize the signing and development of young pitchers. His strategy began with flexing the Yankees' financial muscle in the amateur market, even if it meant spitting in the face of the commissioner's unofficial slotting system, in which teams could conspire to hold down signing bonuses by keeping to established ceilings based on the draft position of the player. The Yankees didn't play by those rules because money wasn't a problem for them. This meant the Yankees would even buy up the amateur medical risks, throwing big money at pitchers with high ceilings that scared off most clubs because of the possibility they were breakdowns waiting to happen. Most clubs could not afford to take the financial risk of handing out a huge signing bonus for a first-round talent with arm trouble. The Yankees could do so because if the player never made it to the big leagues, they were only out some pocket change. It would change nothing about how they did business. If the pitcher defied the medical reports, they had themselves a potential homegrown ace. That's exactly how the Yankees wound up with Alan Horn, who had reconstructive elbow surgery in college after Cleveland picked him in the first round out of high school. Andrew Brackman, who went straight from the draft to the operating room to have Tommy John surgery. And the burly kid who brought the Yankees brass to New Britain on July 20th, 2007, Jabba Chamberlain, whose shaky medical reports regarding his arm, knee, and weight — he weighed as much as 290 pounds at the University of Nebraska — scared off most teams before the Yankees took him with the 41st overall pick of the 2006 draft. Cashman and the Yankees finally got religion when it came to young pitching, and their faith mostly was tied up in three right-handers: Phil Hughes, Ian Kennedy, and Chamberlain. It was Cashman's hope that these were the bedrocks of the next Yankee dynasty, or, in the very least, three reasons to keep him from blowing another $255 million. "The message that I've got for everybody," Cashman told the Hartford Courant while in New Britain, "is that if you pitch to the point where it forces us to look at guys that are not Roger Clemens, I want that." The Yankees' rotation at that moment consisted of three guys past their prime: Pettitte, 35, Messina, 38, and Clemens, 44, and two international free agents, Wang, 27, and Egawa, 27. Chamberlain pitched poorly with the Yankees brass looking at him in New Britain. He gave up 7 runs on 9 hits in less than 5 innings. Still, the Yankees liked what they saw: a fastball that was clocked in the upper 90-mile-per-hour range, and a violent slider. His changeup and curveball were major league quality as well. Cashman called Torrey from New Britain and said, "You'll love him. He's better than Hughes." "That," Torrey said, "got my attention." The Yankees immediately put Chamberlain on the fast track to the Bronx. 4 days after the Yankees executives saw him in New Britain, Chamberlain was in AAA, and just 7 days after that, Chamberlain was in the big leagues. The only catch was that Chamberlain was not permitted to start. Indeed, Cashman and Contreras sent Chamberlain to Torrey with instructions on how he could be used, a mandate that came to be known as the Jabba Rules. The Yankees would no longer allow Chamberlain to start because they were concerned about piling up too many innings after throwing 88 and a third innings in the minors, or only one less than he had thrown in 2006 at Nebraska. The rules were that Chamberlain would have to pitch out of the bullpen. He was not to be used to close games. he was not to be used on consecutive days, and he would get one day of rest for every inning he pitched in an outing. The media perceived the Jabba rules as a slap at Torrey. The conventional wisdom was that the Yankees didn't trust Torrey to handle Chamberlain with care, so they had to give him instructions about how to use him. Torrey, however, had no problem with the rules. "No, I really didn't," he said. "Unless I'm very naive. I mean, I know it was written about, and I was asked about it, but unless I was just naive to it, I never took it as anything more than protecting the kid. And Nardi's the one I called. I never talked to Cashman about it. I called Nardi on a regular basis. And the other fact is, I didn't think there was anything wrong with the rules or talking about the rules. It's like a guy with an injury. Why look to hide something?" Chamberlain was an immediate sensation. He was a character straight out of a cornball 1950s Hollywood casting job. A country kid in the big city with a fastball that could reach 100 miles an hour, and a tendency to celebrate strikeouts with a howl and a fist pump. Yankees fans loved his act. So did Torrey. With Chamberlain in front of Rivera, the Yankees had their best late-inning lockdown combination since the tag team of Rivera and Wetland in 1996. Chamberlain would pitch in 19 games for the Yankees, and they would win 17 of them. He allowed only one earned run. With runners in scoring position, he was perfect. Nobody got a hit off him. He struck out 34 of the 91 hitters he faced. He was as close to unhittable as anybody had seen in a long time. A 21-year-old kid who was in college the previous year, mind you. A kid who had never seen big league hitters before. Chamberlain's arrival had the effect of making Kyle Farnsworth rather useless in any meaningful situation, which bothered Yankees fans not at all. Cashman was ecstatic to have signed Farnsworth as a free agent after the 2005 season to a 3-year, $17 million deal. Farnsworth essentially replaced Tom Gordon, who signed as a free agent with Philadelphia. Farnsworth threw hard and owned a nasty, if misbehaving, slider. But the knock on Farnsworth was that he wilted in the big spots. Indeed, only 2 months before the Yankees gave him $17 million, the Braves were 6 outs away from sending their division series against Houston to a fifth and deciding game when Atlanta manager Bobby Cox gave the ball to Farnsworth. Atlanta was leading 6-1. Farnsworth gave up a grand slam in the eighth and a solo home run in the ninth to cough up the lead. Houston won in the 18th inning, sending the Braves home. In the Yankees' 2006 spring training camp, Epler could not contain his enthusiasm over the Farnsworth addition. "Farnsworth is really going to help us," Epler told Borzello, the bullpen catcher. "He's got one of the best sliders in the game." "Yeah, sure, great," an unimpressed Borzello said. "His slider is great, except maybe only one out of every seven is great." Farnsworth did flash nasty stuff. Opposing hitters batted .242 against him in his 2 years pitching for Torrey, as long as there were no runners in scoring position. With runners in scoring position, Farnsworth wasn't as tough to hit. They batted .272 against him in those spots. The other curious glitch in the Yankees' $17 million reliever was that Farnsworth was built like an NFL tight end, and somehow he was one of their more brittle pitchers, mostly due to a balky back that might go out on him while warming in the bullpen. It was Torrey's understanding that the Yankees did not want him to use Farnsworth 2 days in a row. In 2 years under Torrey, Farnsworth made only 20 of his 136 appearances without rest, and he was generally poor in those situations, posting a 5.60 ERA in those rare times when Torrey did use him on back-to-back days. "I was told we shouldn't use him 2 days in a row," Torrey said. "Billy Epler and Cash, I mean. That was their baby when they brought him on." The arrangement created a problem for Torrey. By trying to avoid using him on back-to-back days, Torrey could not give Farnsworth tune-up work in games that appeared to be already decided. If Torrey did throw him into such games, he would not have Farnsworth available the next day in a game where he might be needed to set up Rivera. It was a catch-22. The problem, however, was that Farnsworth didn't know he came with his own set of instructions. He was also a highly emotional sort. On May 19th at Shea Stadium, for instance, Torrey found Farnsworth on the floor in the corner of the tiny run-down trainer's room in the visiting clubhouse, crying. Farnsworth was hurt because his teammates disapproved of comments he made to the media that Clemens was getting special treatment from the Yankees. On June 29th in Baltimore, Torrey brought Farnsworth in to pitch the eighth inning with a 10-4 lead. He promptly gave up two runs, inflating his ERA to 4.57. Farnsworth had pitched only once in the previous 7 days, and he was angry about his lack of work. He popped off to the press after the game, saying, "I didn't come here to sit the bench." "Farnsworth," Torrey said, "was a good kid. Just a little emotional, that's all. I don't think he was trying to show me up. He was just upset, that's all." Torrey arranged for a meeting with Farnsworth and invited Cashman, too. Farnsworth said he wanted to be traded. "Listen," Torrey said, "it's tough for me to bring you in a game we're way ahead or way behind just to get you an inning, knowing I can't use you the next day, because I don't know if I'll need you the next day in a close game." "What are you guys talking about?" Farnsworth said. He had no idea about the ban on pitching him back-to-back days. "I want to pitch." "Fine," Torrey said. "I'll make sure you don't go more than 3 days in a row without pitching, whatever the score, and then we'll take our chances," said Torrey. He seemed perfectly satisfied with that. And I think he was satisfied with my reasoning, as opposed to thinking I had something against him, I guess. That was the end of the whole scene. Then once Jabba came on the scene, well, he basically took a back seat. That was that. Farnsworth finished the season with a 4.80 ERA while allowing 89 base runners in 60 innings. The next spring, he blamed Torrey for his lousy season. "It's tough when you do lose the confidence from your manager to maybe prepare yourself, day in and day out, when you have no clue about anything," Farnsworth told reporters. "It happened a few times last year." With Chamberlain in front of Rivera rather than Farnsworth, the Yankees were almost impossible to beat when they held a late lead. The Yankees played 50 games after Chamberlain joined the team. The team that began the year 21-29 in its first 50 games went 32-18 in its final 50. The only hitch to the run was the pitching of Messina, who was so bad, giving up 19 runs in 9 2/3 innings over 3 starts, that on August 29th, Torrey decided to pull him from the rotation in favor of Ian Kennedy. Messina was sitting in the tiny office of clubhouse manager Rob Kukuzza that day when Torrey walked in. "I'm going to have Kennedy start in your spot," Torrey told Messina after he heard the Yankee organization had already informed Kennedy of the change. "This doesn't mean you're out of the rotation." "Well, it sure sounds like that's what it is to me," Messina replied. Said Messina, and he was gone in like 45 seconds. Messina was hurt. Being taken out of the rotation was bad enough. The only game he ever pitched in relief was that 2003 ALCS Game 7 gem, but being dropped in 45 seconds chapped him. The next day he marched into Torrey's office. "You would never have done that to Mo or Derek or anybody else," Messina said. "And I've been here for 7 years. I deserve better than that." "You're right," Torrey said. Said Messina, "I should have been in his office, and there should have been more discussion. Ultimately, when you let all the negative stuff settle out, I agreed with him. I probably needed a break. I was fried and pitching terribly. And I got back in there like 10 days later or whatever, and I pitched better. The guys made a lot of right decisions. It ended up being the right thing to do. It got me away from it for a while, and then when I came back, I was better, and my head was better, which is most of the battle. When you have a manager that completely trusts you to do your job, you can't ask for any more than that as a player. Even when he took me out of the rotation, and even though it wasn't done the way I think it should have been done, a couple days later I'm like, you know what? I probably should have come out of the rotation even though I didn't like it. And I didn't like the way he did it, but it's okay." Messina became a reliable pitcher when he returned to the rotation in September. On September 25th, the Yankees arrived in Tampa with a chance to clinch the wild card. They held a 5.5-game lead over Detroit with 6 games to play. The Yankees took a 5-0 lead into the 6th inning that night, but Edouard Ramirez and Brian Bruni coughed up 6 runs in that inning alone. The Yankees eventually lost 7-6 on a 10th-inning home run by Dioner Navarro off Jeff Karstens. The next day, Torrey was summoned to a meeting in the Legends Field conference room with Steinbrenner, or more accurately, the family members who had assumed the daily operations of the franchise from the boss. There was nothing unusual about the need for a meeting. Whenever the Yankees played Tampa Bay, the manager usually was obligated to make an appearance at the team headquarters in Tampa. Torrey wasn't sure if his job status would be discussed, though. True to his spring training vow, he preferred not to talk about it anyway. Torrey expected Steinbrenner, his sons Hank and Hal, and son-in-law Felix Lopez to be at the meeting. When Torrey walked into the room, he saw that all of them were there except Hank. Steinbrenner didn't bother to say hello, as is his usual custom. He believes in the dramatic element of in medias res when it comes to his telephone calls and meetings. "What happened last night?" was how Steinbrenner greeted Torrey. "Don't worry, boss," Torrey said. "We'll get him tonight." It was classic Torrey. Smooth, familiar, and, above all, disarming and reassuring to the man he called by his nickname or his first name, not by the deferential Mr. Steinbrenner. This was not classic Steinbrenner, however. He didn't say much at all. He sat there, slightly slouched, and kept his dark glasses on in the indoor room. At one point he got up to make himself a sandwich. He contributed almost nothing to the meeting. It was obvious to Torrey that Steinbrenner's reign, as everyone knew it, was over, which meant he would no longer be able to deal directly with Steinbrenner when it came time to talk about his future with the team. "It was sad," Torrey said. "As much as you might have been confrontational with him at times or hated what he did, you hate to see that. It was sad. Because now you knew it. The other guys were running the team. A few years before, he would say, 'I'm going to back out of this and let other people take over. Let the young elephants into the tent.' But that was never going to be the case. It's not quite the same when Don Corleone was shot and was recovering and was sitting in the garden. At least he was talking to his son in a very lucid way, explaining what was going to happen. I don't think George had those capabilities. And when you talk to anybody in the organization, Steve Swindell being one, when he was in good graces, you'd ask, 'What's wrong with him?' And they'd say, 'Nothing. We don't know.' I believed him when he told me that." As Steinbrenner occupied himself with his sandwich, the rest of them talked about how happy everyone was with the young pitching. In addition to Chamberlain, Phil Hughes and Ian Kennedy were throwing well for the Yankees. "Kennedy," mused Lopez. "That's a great name for marketing. Better than Rodriguez." The Yankees, they believed, looked like a dangerous postseason team again. The lineup was formidable. The Yankees wound up scoring more runs than any Yankee team in 70 years. The bullpen was dominating with Chamberlain and Rivera at the back end, and the rotation appeared decent enough, with Chen Ming Wang, Andy Pettit, a hobbled but game Roger Clemens — he was nursing yet another injury to his legs — and Messina, who seemed to be back on track after a mostly miserable summer. "Nobody wants to play the Yankees in the playoffs," Hal crowed. "I like to think we intimidate people," Torrey said, "but it depends on which team you're talking about." It was a cheery enough lunch meeting. The Yankees were headed to the playoffs for the 12th consecutive season under Torrey. The food was good, and nobody brought up the question of whether Torrey, even after bringing the team back from 21-29 to easily win a postseason spot, would continue to manage the club. "My situation never came up," Torrey said. "I didn't ask or anything. Basically, I felt like cash was on my side, and I'd leave it to him to ultimately present it." That night, true to the promise Torrey gave Steinbrenner, the Yankees beat Tampa Bay 12-4 to clinch a postseason berth. Steinbrenner watched the game from a luxury box at Tropicana Field. The final out had the familiar patina of the good old days. Steinbrenner watching, Rivera pitching, Posada catching, Jeter, who had homered in the game, at shortstop, and Torrey in the dugout. The Yankees, beset by injuries and a malaise that put them in that 21-29 hole, unloosed a wild celebration in the Tropicana Field visiting clubhouse. This was the 29th time that Torrey's Yankees earned the privilege of spraying champagne over themselves amid the triumph of clinching a playoff spot or winning a postseason series. But this one was different from all the others. This road to October, Jeter told reporters, has definitely been the hardest one. Torrey obviously felt the same way. He called the team together for a toast in the middle of the clubhouse, and as he began, he could not help but think about all the team had been through that season, and all that he had been through. When he began to speak, he could hardly get the words out. "I'm proud of each and every one of you guys," Torrey said. He was tearing up. He continued as best he could. "This one," he said, his voice cracking, "means a lot to me." He was choking up. He wanted to continue, to tell his players how important this postseason berth meant to him, but he could not speak. All he could do was bow his head and try to gather himself. No words would come. There was a brief, awkward silence in the room as the ball players waited to see if Torrey could pull himself together. And then an old friend stepped in to save him from the emotions and the awkwardness. Jeter, who had taken part in all 29 of these parties, reached over and pulled the hat off Torrey's head and dumped a bottle of champagne on his manager. The room erupted in a big cheer, and the celebration started anew in full force. 29 times Torrey helped bring the Yankees to this kind of celebration. 29 times, including at least once every year for 12 consecutive seasons. 29 times. And yet this one, at the end of a long, painful season, was unlike all the others. There would never be another. 15. Attack of the Midges. Major League managers hate the best-of-five games format of the division series. The inferior team has a better chance to beat the superior team in a shorter series than what the best-of-seven league championship series and World Series offer. The smaller the sample, the more havoc the chance can create. Moreover, managers must decide between using three starting pitchers or four, especially if a loss in Game 1 creates the palpable urgency of having to win three out of the next four games. Torrey's 2007 Yankees, the 94-win American League wildcard entrant, drew the Cleveland Indians, the 96-win AL Central champions, in this best-of-five-game anxiety attack. The Indians owned the home field advantage, which meant they would host the first two games, a comforting arrangement for a young team that had not played a playoff game since 2001, had lost all six games it had played against the Yankees that season, and had scored 157 fewer runs than New York, or almost a full run fewer per game. "We have to focus on not playing the Yankees, but playing our